I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, the UN demands an end to battles in the Syrian town of Qusair. The Syria conflict hits the Lebanese economy.
Everyone is in crisis management mode at the moment, in downsizing mode, not in growth mode, definitely.
Iran's culture minister reportedly pushes for additional media restrictions. And Egypt fears diversion of Nile waters for a new dam. It's all ahead. The UN Human Rights Council voted to condemn the Syrian regime's use of foreign fighters in the battle-torn town of Qusair. He's ordered an urgent probe into deaths there. 36 of the council's 47 member states voted in favor. Lisa Schlein reports from the conference site in Geneva.
The United Nations Human Rights Council went into an emergency session on Syria on Wednesday to debate a draft resolution to end fighting around the strategic town of Qusair. The draft, referring to Hezbollah, Lebanon's militant Shiite group, condemned the presence of foreign fighters, siding with the government of President Bashar al-Assad as a serious threat to regional security. But Syria's government was not without its supporters. Before the proceedings began, the Russian representative objected to holding a special session on Syria, saying the matter could be handled as part of regular business. But he was quickly overruled, and the debate began with a speech by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay. She presented a long list of what she said are human rights violations being committed by both government and rebel forces against civilians.
In the run-up to the proposed international conference on Syria in Geneva, states, especially those with influence on the combatants, must collectively act to stop this dreadful conflict from getting even worse. The collapse of the state of Syria would have devastating consequences, not just for Syrians, but also for the region and the whole world.
The United States, which together with Turkey and Qatar requested the special session, also condemned recent government airstrikes of Qusair. U.S. Ambassador to the Council, Eileen Donahoe.
The assault on Qusair is the latest in the regime's attempt to use sectarian-driven war to divide the Syrian people. We are deeply concerned about the risks of increasing sectarian violence from all sides. We condemn Hezbollah's direct role in the hostilities, a role which inflames regional tensions, escalates violence inside Syria, and incites instability in Lebanon.
The Syrian ambassador, Faisal Kabas Hamoui, denounced what he called the cynical and biased attitude of council members. He said no massacres have occurred in Qusair. He accused jihadist groups of terrorizing the people. Speaking through an interpreter, he said Syria helped civilians to leave the town under the protection of Syrian troops.
It gave the armed people a chance to give up their weapons and to leave the town without harm. However, some of them, under orders from Qatar and Turkey, were determined to continue the fight, holding thousands of civilians as human shields.
Russia's foreign minister said Wednesday that the UN body's debate would hamper efforts to organize a peace conference on Syria. He said he was surprised to see the U.S. among the authors of the resolution, saying it runs contrary to the U.S. pledge to help organize the peace conference. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The UN chief has expressed his opposition to arming either side in the two-year conflict in Syria. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's comments came during a news conference at UN headquarters in New York.
My position on this issue has been clear and consistent. I have been urging all the parties who would have influence to both sides. They should urge both sides to stop fighting. And there is no shortage of arms in both sides. Providing arms to either side will not help this process. There is no such military solution in this case. I think only a political process can resolve this issue in a sustainable way.
His comments came a day after Russia announced its intention to go through with the sale of S-300 anti-missile batteries to Damascus. While on Monday, the European Union's arms ban showed signs of cracking, with France and Britain pushing to arm the opposition. In Turkey, Syrian National Coalition spokesman Khaled Saleh said arming the rebels would level the playing field.
We've said very clearly that there must be a shift in the balance of power on the ground. And I think this is, especially with the lifting of the arms embargo from the EU, the leading position of the UK, the leading position of France, I think we'll start seeing things change tremendously.
At his UN news conference, Mr. Ban also expressed his concern about the Lebanon-based Hezbollah militants who are actively fighting the rebels alongside Syrian security forces.
We are very much concerned that many actors are now involved in this. My strong message is that fighting must stop immediately, so that the political process can begin. That's the best way at this time.
Mr. Ban's views on Hezbollah's involvement in the fighting in Syria were echoed Wednesday in a media briefing by U.S. spokesperson Jen Psaki at the State Department in Washington, who warned of a wider conflict in the region.
This is an unacceptable and extremely dangerous escalation. We demand that Hezbollah withdraw its fighters from Syria immediately. We remain deeply concerned about reports of multiple cross-border security incidents in recent days. We also condemn yesterday's outrageous attack on a Lebanese army checkpoint near Arsal, which killed 3 soldiers. These and other incidents are stark reminders that the conflict in Syria poses an incredibly dangerous threat to Lebanon's stability, the people of Lebanon, and security. We call on all parties to do their part to act with restraint and respect Lebanon's stability and security.
Syria's opposition is demanding a deadline for President Bashar al-Assad to leave power if it is to attend proposed international peace talks in Geneva next month. Meeting in Istanbul Wednesday, opposition leaders say they want binding international guarantees, including what they call the removal of the head of the regime and its military command. Syrian Foreign Minister Walid al-Molum says the Assad government is willing to attend the talks with no preconditions. The civil war in Syria has devastated its economy, destroyed significant parts of its infrastructure, and displaced millions of people. It is also hurting the economy of neighboring Lebanon, which was enjoying strong growth until the war erupted some 2 years ago. In this report for VOA Television, correspondent Scott Bob takes us to Ashrafia, a traditionally Christian neighborhood in Beirut.
Early evening in Ashrafia, a Beirut district known for its nightlife, the Kukli restaurant is getting ready to open for dinner. Owner Ziad Kamel oversees the preparations. Business is tough. Since the Syrian war began 2 years ago, the number of tourists visiting Lebanon has fallen by more than a third. Tourism revenues are down by almost one half.
A lot of restaurants, a lot of bars that have had to shut down. Hotels also have had to shut down. If not the whole thing, they have had to sort of shut down half the hotel and operate at on a skeleton staff. Everyone is in crisis management mode at the moment, in downsizing mode, not in growth mode, definitely.
Kamel says his restaurant is still profitable, though barely, because it caters primarily to locals. But he had to close his flagship restaurant on the marina because it catered to wealthy foreign tourists who no longer come. Because of the Syrian crisis, Lebanon's economy grew last year less than 1%, down from average annual growth of 8%, says Biblos Bank's chief economist, Nasib Gobril.
I would say the area that suffered the most is consumer confidence and investor sentiment, and that has been reflected on economic activity and therefore on real GDP growth.
In addition, nearly a half million Syrian refugees have streamed into Lebanon, and that has strained government services, healthcare, and infrastructure. Gobril says if the Syrian conflict ends soon, Lebanon's economy will quickly recover.
A negotiated solution to the Syrian crisis would bring that positive political shock to Lebanon, and it will help consumer confidence and investor sentiment recover, and therefore it will help economic growth pick up rather quickly, given that the Lebanese economy is driven by the private sector.
Ziad Kamel says Lebanese are good at crisis management. Many businessmen have left, but he says it's important to invest in one's country.
If all of us leave,
then the people remaining here will certainly not be able to inspire enough change in the country for it to one day be normalized, whatever that means.
A few hours later, Kukli restaurant is open. Business is good. The conflict in Syria seems far away. But so does any end to it. And that is what worries Lebanese business people the most. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Beirut.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Foreign journalists trying to report on Iran's presidential election in June could soon face even tighter controls. Iran's semi-official Mehr news agency says the country's culture minister is pushing for additional restrictions. We asked for a reaction from Sharif Mansour of the Committee to Protect Journalists.
We feel this is a grave violations in a very sensitive time. We know that this election is going to be important. There are a lot of stakes in terms of issues that the new president is going to face once elected that is important to the Iranian people. And they deserve the right to know who are the candidates and know more information about the process and have a media environment that's open, transparent, and have diverse opinion. We don't see that happening this year. We have monitored closely an increase of number of arrests made in the journalist community. We also monitor an increase of censorship for online websites that some of them actually belong to possible candidates and some of the political leaders, and also slowing down of internet in many occasions in sensitive times, like announcing the list of candidates, which was a big news last week. So we feel that this is stifling of important coverage ahead of the election.
You mentioned that this is important for the Iranian people, but it's also very important for the international community.
Absolutely. A lot of people are watching what Iran is going to do this time. There were big controversy last presidential election 2009, and we know that many of the people in the media are excited and looking forward to do their job, which is cover the news. And we think that there should be an opening that allows people to talk more freely around this important time because everyone is watching. But we feel that the Iranian regime have already started silencing and threatening journalists way before the election, as early as January this year, by arresting more people and also waging a campaign against the press, blaming them for quote-unquote the sedition that happened in 2009, and threatening them by saying that they have a list of 600 journalists that they are investigating and already arresting around 20 people this year alone from the journalist community.
Sharif Mansour, Middle East and North Africa coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists in New York. The Iranian Culture Ministry says 200 foreign journalists have applied to cover the June 14th election. It does not say how many of the applications would be approved. About 120 foreign media outlets maintain offices in Iran. Egypt is expressing concern at Ethiopia's move to divert water from the Nile River to allow construction of a massive hydroelectric dam. VOA's Peter Heinlein reports.
Egypt's cabinet met Wednesday to discuss Ethiopia's announcement that it is diverting the flow of the Blue Nile, the main tributary of the river. The meeting came a day after Ethiopian officials said the water would be diverted to make way for construction of a nearly $5 billion dam. The hydropower facility will be the largest in Africa, producing as much electricity as 6 nuclear power plants. It is scheduled for completion in 2017. A statement carried by Egypt's state-run MENA news agency said construction measures already in progress do not reflect any approval by Cairo to build the dam. Egypt's ambassador to Ethiopia, Mohamed Idris, tells VOA his country is not surprised by the diversion. It had been expected. But he suggested the unilateral announcement was premature, coming days before a panel of experts from Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia releases a long-awaited study on the impact of the dam.
These are technical issues, and you cannot just give judgmental or give impressionistic view on these implications. That's why the three countries formed these panel of experts, which includes national experts and international experts of world status and high reputation in their fields. And this panel of experts, which is now almost completing its work, is entrusted with the mandate of making this scientific assessment of the implications on Egypt and Sudan. And based on the report of this panel, the three countries will decide on how to proceed.
Ethiopian officials this week sought to assure the downstream countries, Egypt and Sudan, that the 550-meter diversion, or shifting of the river from its natural course, would not mean any loss of water and could be a boon to future regional energy needs. Ethiopian officials emphasized that water levels would not be affected by the diversion. But Ambassador Idris said Egypt's almost total dependence on the Nile for its water supply makes any potential disruption a national security issue.
The Nile, for us, is not just other river. It is the only source of life in Egypt. So that's any impact on the water reaching Egypt is going to affect the Egyptian water security and affect the life of the Egyptian people. And this is for something of great concern.
The envoy said Egypt and Sudan will insist on being a party to any decisions that will affect the river's flow.
The important issue is how the three countries would set the course for moving forward on the project based on the agreed principles of shared benefit and no harm and win-win. The Egyptian side insists on abiding by these principles and by these commitments.
Ethiopian Deputy Prime Minister Debretsion Gebremichael this week said the Renaissance Dam could begin producing electricity as early as next year. Responding to the concerns of the downstream countries, he told the Bloomberg News Agency, "This is an international river and we will try our best to accommodate their interests." The Blue Nile originates high in the mountains of Ethiopia. It provides 85% of the Nile's water, joining with the White Nile at the Sudanese capital Khartoum, where it flows north to the Mediterranean Sea. Peter Heinlein, VOA News, Washington.
Turkey's parliament has passed new sweeping regulations controlling alcohol consumption, along with bans on alcohol advertising and its portrayal on television or film, and tighter controls on licenses. Critics are accusing the Islamic-rooted government of imposing its religious beliefs on the country. The government rejects the charge, claiming it's protecting the young. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Among the most controversial of the new restrictions is a ban on the sales of alcohol within 110 yards of a mosque or a school. Many observers predict that it will have major consequences in Istanbul, which has 6,000 schools and mosques, especially in districts like Kadıköy, home to many bars and restaurants. Restaurant owner Ferit Turgut is supervising a beer delivery that could well be one of his last. His restaurant is a meyhane, offering a myriad of small, tasty dishes that you eat with beer, wine or rakı, a potent anise drink. It's a tradition that predates Turkey's 1923 secular republic. But Turgut says, with a mosque at the bottom of the street, the future is bleak.
kapatmak durumunda kalacağım. Yani benim gibi bir sürü iş yeri öyle. Yani sonuçta tabii var biz burası.
I will have to close down, he says. But even before this law, with increasing taxes on alcohol, we were facing bankruptcy. They want to ban alcohol altogether. But drinking has been part of this country for centuries, he says, noting that a whole cuisine has been created for wine and rakı. Rakı, which was the favorite tipple of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the founder of the Secular Republic, was widely touted as a national drink, until the pious Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan declared that ayran, a yogurt drink, would take its place. The new law bans any advertising, sponsorship, or even portrayal of alcohol on television. There's also a curfew on shop sales between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., with a fine of up to $270,000 for violations. The new law has provoked a storm of controversy. The Prime Minister is accused of pursuing a religious agenda, as alcohol is forbidden under the Islamic faith. But Mr. Erdogan claims health rather than religious concerns are driving the policy.
Yani bu dünyanın neresine gidersen git, bugün Amerika'sında da, batısında da bütün bu uygulamalar var.
There are such regulations everywhere in the world, he says, adding that the youth of a nation should be protected from bad habits. We don't want a generation wandering around in a merry state day and night, he says. But Kadri Gusel, a columnist for the Turkish newspaper Milliyet, says such an argument is disingenuous. He claims that under Mr. Erdogan's decade-long rule, alcohol has been systematically driven out of Turkey.
There is a fight in Turkey around alcohol. The areas that one can enjoy in Turkey, a glass of wine is shrinking constantly every year. Inner Anatolia is a huge alcohol-free zone now, and the agenda is a religious conservative, has nothing to do with fight against alcoholism, because there is no such a social problem of alcoholism in Turkey.
Turkish alcohol consumption is the lowest in Europe. Since Prime Minister Erdogan took office, the level of taxation on alcohol has jumped from one of the world's lowest to among the highest at 100%. The government has warned of further hikes. But Mr. Erdogan this week played down concerns about an outright ban, saying that people are free to drink at home. Attila Yeşilada is an analyst with Global Source Partners, a political consulting firm. He says electoral politics can explain the crackdown.
Very controversial new law on banning or restricting consumption and sales of alcohol. Tip of the iceberg, as we approach the elections, we'll see more legislation that appeals to the conservative / Islamist voters. And it's going to go on like that.
Observers warn that the ferocious debate over alcohol reveals how deeply polarized Turkey remains over the country's direction. A polarization that is only expected to deepen with the approach of elections next year. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul, Turkey.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.